Right now, we turn to the world of social media. Last week, Facebook's CEO, Mark Zuckerberg, did something he hasn't done in a long time. He laid out ambitious goals for the social network's place in the world.
In a piece just shy of 6,000 words, Zuckerberg stepped into a raging debate over the merits of globalization. He gave not a lot of specifics in his letter, but he talked about making Facebook something that brings people together worldwide. He said, quote, "Progress now requires humanity coming together, not just as cities or nations, but as a global community."
The letter touched on everything from terrorism to fake news, but was careful not to overtly mention politics. Katie Culver joins us now. She's an assistant professor and director of UW-Madison Center for Journalism Ethics. Katie, welcome back to Central Time.
Oh, I'm so happy to be here.
Well, what struck you when you were looking over this long post from Mark Zuckerberg?
I think the thing that struck me first and foremost is that he is trying to build ties between our digital connections and our in-person connections. I think he realizes that community is built when we are in contact with each other in real life, but that digital communities can supplement that.
It's an interesting time. If you would turn back the clock, let's say, 5 years or so, it would be probably a given that the world was moving toward a global society with increased connections, but that same world is not the world we inhabit today, and so in comes Mark Zuckerberg. Is this a daring thing of him to do at this particular moment in time?
I'd push back on you just a little bit and say that it's not necessarily the world that we do not inhabit today. We see some people pushing back against globalization, but there is a march toward globalization. And one of the things that we all have to recognize is that we have had an incredibly sustained time of global peace. There have been incredible crises in some areas, but this has been a time of peace, and we have to be careful if we retreat from trade agreements and that sort of thing. And I think Zuckerberg recognizes that, and he recognizes the power of Facebook in this environment.
Well, and there are questions about trade agreements still going on right now. We have Brexit possibly in the works in various iterations. We have what some call the nationalism of Donald Trump. So does that mean that some of these features about a global community, you know, people have different perspectives on them right now?
Different perspectives, and to the extent that tools like Facebook let us air those disagreements and let us discuss them and comment on them, I think that's very important. It's clear that, at least it was clear to me in this latest Zuckerberg post, that he recognizes that Facebook is a tool for something larger than people may have thought earlier.
And in concert with this post, he also went on a listening tour, and some people were saying he's going to run for president. He's becoming political. What do you think about that sort of chatter?
I don't know. I don't know if Mark Zuckerberg would ever run for president, but I do, and I don't think he's necessarily political. I think he's finding his voice, which is good because, you know, coming off of some of the sort of fake news, hoax, conspiracy theories that were trending on Facebook, initially his response was denial, and I didn't think that was a good response. So to have him thinking more deeply about Facebook's role and about the influence that it has as a platform and that he has as a person, I think those are good developments.
He seems to really want to build communities within the online world, and he mentioned them mirroring some institutions that we see now, like churches and governments. I mean, there were not a lot of specifics about that kind of thing, but what do you think he has in mind?
Well, I think part of it is recognizing that we have strong social ties when we meet people face-to-face, and that those ties can be weakened when we're only meeting people digitally. But when you have the combination of the two, when you know people face-to-face, but you can connect with them digitally, that's where the real power is. So, for instance, it's very easy for us to use words online that we would not use in person. But when we have a group that we connect with live and then we can continue those connections online, those can be really, really powerful bridges.
When do you see this, how would you see this shape coming up as he pursues this goal of having these communities online? And you've got, you know, a world where there are different mores for different sorts of things to be posted. How would it work, do you think?
Well, I think it's one of the challenges for a lot of people like me that care about media ethics. You know, one of the things that we think about is what are some shared human values? What are the things that cut across cultures? What can we promote? And I think one of the underlying themes of this manifesto, as people have called it, is tolerance, and that tolerance is something that cuts across cultures, and it's something that we as humans should be preserving and protecting. And I think he's looking for ways to for Facebook to sort of build that in to their architecture.
You mentioned tolerance. Do you see this posting of his as a response to the 2016 election in some way?
I'm not sure that I would go that far. I do think that it's a response to what some have described as an increasing sense of nationalism or isolationism. And let's be clear, he's got a corporate interest here. Facebook is, as a corporation, an entity with global reach. He's got to protect that global reach in his own mind or for his own company's interests. But I think he's also more philosophically saying that this is a world in which we are all connected and we can't retreat from that.
And you mentioned earlier that you didn't think his response to criticism of Facebook sort of enabling fake news as being adequate. What do you think about where he is now on that?
I think Facebook as a whole has moved in the right direction. I wouldn't ever presuppose to get in the mind of Mark Zuckerberg personally, but you know their actions over the last 2 months have really been steps in the right direction to say that, well, this is something that proliferated on our platform. You saw in this manifesto that he was talking about problematic content, even if it's only a very, very small percentage of their content, because they have so many users, it has much greater reach. So I think they've made moves in the right direction. I'd like to continue to see them go in that course.
We're talking right now with Katie Culver, director of UW-Madison Center for Journalism Ethics, and we're looking at the future of Facebook after Mark Zuckerberg posted a letter last week where he said he sees Facebook's place in the global community.
You can join in at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. If you read that letter from the Facebook creator, Mark Zuckerberg, tell us what you thought of it. If you are a user of Facebook, tell us whether or not you think the company needs to revise its content policy. Do you think Facebook and other social media do more to bring us together as a community, or do they do a lot to pull us apart? How do you think Facebook and other social media should deal with issues like fake news and fact-checking? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234.
And we're picking up the conversation with Katie Culver, director of UW-Madison Center for Journalism Ethics. And we're looking at Mark Zuckerberg's recent manifesto on the role and future of Facebook, in which he promoted the idea of connecting a global community.
You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Tell us what you thought of Mark Zuckerberg's goals for the future of Facebook and his call for a more connected world. What did you think of his thoughts on globalization, and how does social media fit into your life, your news diet? Do you rely on it to see stories out there? Do you feel like you're caught in a bit of a Facebook filter bubble? Do you see it bringing communities together or pulling people apart? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we'll take our first caller now. We've got Calvin on the line in Duluth. Calvin, hi.
Hi.
What do you want to share?
My point, I guess, was that fake news is a fake problem, or at least it's very ahistorical to try to pin it on Facebook or the internet. We've had a lot of fake news in the past, such as Judith Miller's reporting in the New York Times, repeating the fabricated claims of WMDs in Iraq. There's also the hysteria around Russia interference in the election, which has been repeated countless times, but with zero evidence, zero public evidence, at least.
And so Calvin, go ahead.
So I think fake news has been an issue ever since we've had news as such. And it's been an issue with the New York Times and the Washington Post and other mainstream or corporate media.
Calvin, thank you for the comments. He's saying fake news is more ubiquitous in his estimation than we think it is. It's not just a Facebook thing. What do you think about that, Katie?
So raises an excellent point, and one that I've been talking about for the last, I don't even know how long, and that is that we should be in the business of specificity as journalists. We shouldn't use the term fake news. You see Donald Trump calling the New York Times, CBS, CNN, ABC fake news. So the term has been co-opted, and it's not the right term. We should call a hoax a hoax. We should call a conspiracy theory a conspiracy theory. And Calvin is right. The reporting leading up to the war in Iraq on weapons of mass destruction was flawed reporting. But it was flawed reporting for very specific reasons, and we need to talk about that. We relied on anonymous sources. We let people share information without any blowback on them personally. So we have to be very careful about those kinds of practices. There were outlets that got the run-up to the Iraq war right, but they were engaging in practices that other mainstream media were not using. So we need to be very careful and very specific about what is going wrong and why it's going wrong.
Katie, overall, how do you process this? I guess people are calling it a manifesto from Mark Zuckerberg. Is it an impassioned and maybe brave, from depending on your point of view, sort of creed de coeur about the benefits of globalization? Or is this motivated maybe more from a business perspective?
I suspect, again, without having any conversation with Mark Zuckerberg, I suspect it's both. I suspect that it is trying to preserve Facebook's role and defend it to some extent. It's been under attack. But I also think he has goals. He has a vision for societies that he thinks work together. And I think those are admirable goals. And I don't know about you, but I personally have groups that I stay in touch with on Facebook, and I'm grateful for that platform. It helps me have strong social ties with those groups. But those groups don't exist only online. They exist in real time with real people, and then we use those online mechanisms to support each other.
Katie, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, it was wonderful to be with you guys, and good luck with your pledge drive.
Thanks a lot. Well, that was Katie Culver, assistant professor and director of UW-Madison Center for Journalism Ethics. She was with us there to talk about Facebook's new direction after CEO Mark Zuckerberg posted a public letter on the social network's role in a global society.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferrer.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Over the last 2 months, there have been waves of bomb threats directed at Jewish community centers around the country. Earlier this week, the Milwaukee Area Center in Whitefish Bay was evacuated for the second time in a month, and today a center in New Orleans reported a similar threat.
The threats come in the midst of a wave of reported anti-Semitic harassment and vandalism, including the targeting of a Jewish cemetery in Missouri, the foiling of an alleged shooting plot targeting a synagogue in Florida, and reports of synagogue vandalism in Chicago and elsewhere.
And a report from the Milwaukee Jewish Community Relations Council saw a 60% jump in anti-Semitic incidents in Wisconsin from 2015 to 2016.
Jessica Gall joins us now for a look at these incidents and threats and the response from the Trump administration. She's Associate Regional Director for the Anti-Defamation League in Chicago. The ADL itself was targeted yesterday by a bomb threat at its New York headquarters. Jessica, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Well, how widespread have these bomb threats been? We've heard of them, of course, in Milwaukee, at the Jewish Community Center there, around the country, the ADL itself. How many of these are we seeing?
So we are seeing, unfortunately, a large number of bomb threats really across the nation in multiple states. Obviously, yes, in Wisconsin, Minnesota, Illinois, that covers a large swath of our region. But we are seeing this across the country and, as you said, at the ADL National Office in New York City. Thankfully, none of these have actually been real bombs, which of course is great news, but any report of a bomb threat is incredibly scary and definitely disrupts operations, disrupts the day, and really increases fear within a community. So yes, we are definitely seeing this across the nation and repeated waves of these different threats across the nation.
And then apart from the bomb threats, we've seen this vandalism at the Missouri cemetery. What other sorts of incidents of anti-Semitism, harassment, threats are we seeing these days?
So we, yes, the cemetery situation in Missouri, obviously incredibly horrific to think about. graves being vandalized, but then also here in Chicago, we had vandalism done to the Loop Synagogue with swastikas posted as well. We have also seen other reports from different campuses across the country of swastikas, maybe not necessarily specific anti-Semitic events, but of course a swastika being posted or graffiti along those lines being put up in to various communities raise a level of fear, raise a level of concern of folks both within the Jewish community, other communities, as well as the larger community.
Are we seeing more anti-Semitic threats and harassment recently, or is this something that's kind of always going on, we're just paying more attention to it now?
I think that's a really great question, because we really need to temper ourselves and really look at the facts. You know, what is being reported, what are investigated and authorized incidents or crimes that have taken place. And while we don't have, statistics on what the rise has been, we can say that within the past 6 months or so, we have seen an increase in anti-Semitic incidents and crimes across the country. And, we can try and point to different events that may have sparked that, but really we're not really quite sure why that is the case. But we have seen an increase in reported incidents, yes.
Right. We don't know, for example, who is making these bomb threats or what their motivation is, but what are some of the things that you're talking about when it comes to why we're seeing more incidents overall?
We spent a lot of time thinking about that. We definitely have seen far more rhetoric within the campaign season. I think that potentially that could have had some contribution into some of these things. We saw some corresponding evidence potentially of that, but again, we can't point to that and say that that's the reason. Have seen some folks maybe feeling a little bit more emboldened to make some of these statements or do some of these things. But as far as, a movement of any sort of a certain group or a certain group of people doing these kinds of things, we don't necessarily, have evidence of that. We're still conducting that research, compiling the data to actually see, where some of these threats have come from and who are perpetrating some of these incidents and crimes.
Speaking of the campaign, you at ADL had done a report on threats against Jewish journalists throughout
Yes.
the course of the campaign, and just horrific stuff, Holocaust references, pasting journalists who are Jewish or who the poster thought was Jewish, their picture in Holocaust-related scenes. What did you find in that report?
So, yeah, basically when we look at, an overall data pull of these incidents, we saw that, there were, 2.641 million total mentions of different anti-Semitic types of words, tweets directed at journalists that include that type of rhetoric. We've also, we saw that there was, that at least 800 journalists received anti-Semitic tweets with an estimated reach of 45 million impressions. The top 10 most targeted journalists, all of whom are Jewish, received 83% of these anti-Semitic tweets. So, this is incredibly concerning, and we are working with different social media platforms to help them respond to these issues. How can they, tighten their user agreements, their policies on these types of tweets or posts, and really protect the users and the journalists specifically who are conveying information in this way.
Talking to Jessica Gall. She's with the Anti-Defamation League based in Chicago. Jessica, I want to get into the presidential reaction to this. This has been in the news. We're going to listen to a couple things. President Trump was criticized for two different answers to questions. This is last week about anti-Semitic threats. In one, he talked about his election win for a while before getting into the issue a little. And in a press conference last week, a reporter who identifies as Jewish asked the president about the bomb threats and other incidents after saying he didn't think the president or his staff were anti-Semitic. Here's a listen to some of that exchange.
What we are concerned about and what we haven't really heard being addressed is an uptick in anti-Semitism and how the government is planning to take care of it. There's been a report out that 48 bomb threats have been made against Jewish centers all across the country in the last couple of weeks. There are people who are committing anti-Semitic acts or threatening to...
You see, he said he was going to ask a very simple, easy question. And it's not. It's not. Not a simple question. Not a fair question. Okay, sit down. I understand the rest of your question. So here's the story, folks. Number one, I am the least anti-Semitic person that you've ever seen in your entire life. Number two, racism, the least racist person. In fact, we did very well relative to other people running as a Republican. Quiet, quiet, quiet. See, he lied about he was going to get up and ask a very straight, simple question. So, you know, it's welcome to the world of the media.
And then yesterday, the president spoke more directly to the issue. Here's a listen.
The anti-Semitic threats targeting our Jewish community and community centers are horrible and are painful and a very sad reminder of the work that still must be done to root out hate and prejudice and evil.
And then Vice President Pence had also spoken about the issue at the cemetery in Missouri. What do you think of what you've heard from President Trump and his administration?
Yeah, I think that's a really good question. You know, initially when that question was asked by the journalist, at that time our CEO, national CEO, Jonathan Greenblatt, we issued a statement talking about our disappointment and our, you know, concern around President Trump and his administration's, you know, dodging or, you know, just basically not answering the question around addressing anti-Semitism. And so we really welcome the more recent statements that the administration has made that saying that this is an issue, you know, that not only concerns the Jewish community, of course it concerns the Jewish community, but it really concerns our entire community, because when one group is targeted, it really impacts everyone. And it can create a real, I guess, a chilling effect, you know, if we don't come out strongly and state that this is not okay, that this is something that we need to address and address directly. So we welcome the new statements from the administration, and we hope to work with him to combat, you know, these new issues, this wave of bomb threats and bomb scares, and also the online harassment and the uptick in hate crimes and incidents across the country.
Now, that's the response from the White House. What have you seen from community response, not just from the Jewish community around the country? We've seen, at least in some particular communities, faced with anti-Semitic threats, one small town in Montana targeted for anti-Jewish harassment there. Some people pulling together. Are you encouraged by what you've seen from the communities around the United States?
Yeah, I really am happy that you asked that question. I think this is a real chance for people of marginalized communities, you know, to take a stand and stand in solidarity. And then I think, again, it's a chance for entire communities to take a stand and unite together against something like this. Because someone who identifies as Jewish or identifies as Muslim or is African American or whatever the case might be, whatever group you might belong to, is also a member of that community, and we are, you know, as strong, you know, that individual needs to be strong and the community needs to be strong. So I am incredibly heartened by some of the stories coming from various communities across the country within our region, about communities banding together and saying, you know, not here, that we want to take a stand against hate.
Jessica, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Oh, thank you so much.
That was Jessica Gall, Associate Regional Director for the Anti-Defamation League in Chicago.